Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're talking about intuitive eating. Our guest is Elise Resch, the co-author of the Intuitive Eating Workbook. Elise is a nutrition therapist in private practice in Beverly Hills, California, with 40 years of experience specializing in eating disorders, intuitive eating, and health at every size. She is the co-author of Intuitive Eating, now in its fourth edition, the Intuitive Eating Workbook, and the Intuitive Eating Card Deck. Elise is also the author of the Intuitive Eating Workbook for Teens and the Intuitive Eating Journal. She has published journal articles, print articles, and blog posts. Elise does regular speaking engagements, podcasts, and extensive media interviews. Her work has been profiled on ABC, NPR, NBC, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Associated Press, USA Today, and others. Elise is nationally known for her work in helping patients break free from diet culture through the intuitive eating process. Her philosophy embraces the goal of reconnecting with one's internal wisdom about eating and developing body liberation, with the belief that all bodies deserve dignity and respect. She is a social justice advocate, a member of the Healer Circle of Project Heal, Help to Eat, Accept, and Live, supervises and trains health professionals, is a certified eating disorder specialist and supervisor, a fellow of the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals, and a fellow of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Hi, Elise. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, Cassie, I'm so looking forward to this. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk to you about intuitive eating. It's talked about everywhere for many years now, especially since your first book was published. Can you talk about what intuitive eating is and what it isn't?
I'm so glad you asked me that because there's so many misconceptions out there. One of the biggest misconceptions is it's just about the exact number on the scale for hunger. You must start eating at a certain place. And when you're exactly at the right number for fullness, you need to stop. And there's no other reason to eat than hunger. And that is not it at all. So let me tell you my best definition of intuitive eating. After I say that basically it's a self-care platform for the best way of living one's life. And it's based on 10 principles, which are not rules. So that's an important thing to know. It's just principles, guidelines. And that is kind of the most simple way of looking at it. But my best definition is that it is a dynamic interplay of instinct, emotion, and thought. And let me explain that. The instinctual part of our brains comes from the dinosaurs, the reptilian era, where the dinosaurs only had the survival instinct. So no feelings, no thoughts. They just went and ate little dinosaurs or bushes or whatever to survive. We as just humans have that in our brains as well. And then the next layer of functioning was the mammalian brain or the limbic brain, which is the seat of emotions and social behaviors. And cats and dogs have feelings. They just can't express them. So what differentiates us as humans is that we have the neocortex or the thinking part of the brain. So intuitive eating is not just simply the instinct to survive. It's certainly a big part of it, the instinct to know when you're hungry, when you're full, what foods taste good. But we also have emotions that can affect our instincts. Illnesses, people who have had COVID, people who have colds, you know, they may not have the instinct to eat, their appetite's gone. So that neocortex, that thinking part of the brain, helps us make the best decisions for ourselves, soothe our emotions, listen to our instincts, and then decide what's best for us. So dynamic interplay of instinct, emotion, and thought.
It's such a good promise, just being able to like trust your own instincts. That's why I'm so drawn to intuitive eating. I was wondering if you could talk about how you and Evelyn came up with this concept back in 1995.
Well, I think separately, we each of us knew that what was out there wasn't working. We didn't want to do it. We didn't want to be focused on weight loss. We didn't want to be telling people what to eat, what not to eat. And so I know for myself, I had an idea for a book and I started writing chapter headings and putting ideas out. And Evelyn was renting some office space from me. And I knew that she was interested in writing also. And one day she looked a little, I don't know, dismayed about something when I happened to see her in the hall. And I said, "Evelyn, what's wrong?" And she said, "Oh, I'm trying to write this book with a psychologist and she just doesn't know how to write." And I had that Virginia Woolf moment of being where I went, I'm a good writer. I know that. And I love psychology. And so I just jumped in and I said, "I'll write it with you." So we kind of came together and saw that we had very similar principles, ideas, you know, sense of what we didn't want to do and what we did want to do. And we then combined it. And we were the only dietitians who had written a book about non-diet. There had been some things out there. There had been some therapists. There had been some lay people who had written about the dangers of, you know, dieting and deprivation. But we were the first dietitians. So we were able to frame it in a little more scientific way.
Yeah. And there's just a huge movement that's come along since you've published the book, you know, The Health at Every Size, The Body Positive, Anti-Diet. And you guys were really at the precipice of that. And we talked a little bit about it when you were explaining what intuitive eating is. Can you talk about the real benefits of it?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, there are 200 scientific studies that show that intuitive eating is an evidence-based process for increased physical and mental health. People have higher HDLs, which is the good cholesterol. They have higher self-esteem and well-being and psychological hardiness and better sense of self, of their body image, more pleasure in eating, which is a huge piece of intuitive eating, and better what's called interoceptive awareness, which means being able to hear the messages that your body gives you and respond to them. So that's just a few. Bigger life satisfaction, a better life. There's just so many positive aspects of it.
Yeah. And a big part of it is rejecting that diet mentality. Can you talk about the importance of that and what harm is coming to our mental health from dieting?
Yeah. So dieting is based on something we call diet culture, which is an over $70 billion a year business to get people to feel bad if they're not meeting a certain culturally thin ideal. And so it promotes them to go on restrictive diets, meaning eating less food than their bodies need, feeling deprived because they're not allowed to have enough of something or, you know, what they want to eat at all. And the big picture of it for me is that it's an assault on our autonomy. I think those of us with a healthy, you know, personality, healthy ego, we want to assert our autonomy. I don't like it when people tell me what to do. You know, if somebody, you know, asks me if I'd like something, I can consider if somebody tells me to do something, it's like, no, even if it might be something I'd want. So diets essentially go against your autonomy. They're telling you what to do. So ultimately, people can't stay on diets for many reasons, physiological reasons. The survival part of their brain that I was talking about recognizes organism in danger, red alert. You know, in other words, this is not the part that's thinking or feeling. It just recognizes, senses that the body's in danger. So it will send out chemicals to get the person to eat as many calories, as many carbs as they can just for survival. That's, you know, physiological, neurochemical, the brain is, you know, a part of it. And psychologically, as I said, we cannot take deprivation for very long, and we cannot take an assault on our autonomy, sorry. And so when someone falls, quote unquote, falls off a diet, they start blaming themselves. Their self-esteem is affected by it. And in fact, they haven't done anything wrong. When I have a client come in and say to me, I am a failure at dieting, I say, no, no, no. You are a success at ego development because you could not keep up with something that was externally forced upon you. Diets are very, very harmful psychologically and physiologically.
Yeah, and that's so frustrating too, because our medical system still pushes that. You know, they go on the BMI. Like, let me tell you, every doctor I've been to, from dermatologists to gynecologists, the first thing they talk about is your weight. Like, you come in for a cough and they're like, it's because you're overweight. Like, that is their very first assumption.
Well, first of all, doctors have no more than one course in nutrition in, you know, medical school. Some schools, none. They don't have any courses in eating disorders. They don't understand the impact of what they're doing. And this narrative that our health is determined by our weight is not true. There are so many factors that affect our quote unquote health. And the interesting thing, and I love to tell my clients this, is that really about only 10% of one's health is determined by what they eat or what, you know, how much they move their bodies. The rest of it are social determinants, meaning, do you have safety in your life? Do you have access to enough health care, mental health care? Can you pay your bills? All the things that cause high levels of cortisol, stress hormone, that affects our health more. One's weight is either predetermined, you know, by one's DNA, Or it is affected by diet culture and people go on a diet and fall off of it and then go on another diet and then they start weight cycling. And weight cycling has a negative effect on health. It's not the weight. It's the cycling that can increase risk of diabetes and heart disease and is pro-inflammatory. So I get very angry about what the medical profession in general. I know some doctors who know the truth.
One part of your workbook that resonated with me was the hidden forms of dieting. I wondered if you could say more about that and what that looks like.
Some diets like to say, this is for your well-being. This is for your total health. This is for your wellness, on and on. And then they say, and you will lose a certain amount of weight if you follow these rules. So if there's any kind of reference toward weight, towards counting anything, counting your macros, counting your grams of fat or carbs, you know, counting calories, even though they're putting it out as a non-diet, it's like Weight Watchers, you know, counting points. I have recently heard that not only Weight Watchers, but Noom, another one of these diets that claims it's all psychological, and then of course it blames the person if they can't stay on it, not the diet. They have now bought into selling that drug, Ozempic, which is for people with diabetes. And so I'm laughing about it because I'm thinking, Jenny Craig's gone out of business, and these two well-known companies are saying, basically what they're saying is our diets don't work. So now go on and buy this drug that has not really been, you know, researched and side effects are horrible. But I think it's kind of ironic and funny if you really think about it, because they're admitting diets don't work.
Right. And the whole, you know, I mean, I've struggled with dieting my entire life and I've done the Weight Watchers. The worst one I did was this. It was actually literally starving yourself disguised as a diet. It was called Take Shape for Life, but it was actually like the MetaFast food they feed people before gastric bypass. Like I was basically existing on like 1,000 calories a day for 7 months and I lost the weight. But the minute I ate like a normal person, even like whole, like quote unquote healthy foods, I immediately gained it back and then some. Like, it's just
starvation.
Not sustainable. Yeah.
Sustainable is the most important word, and it's starvation. And so what I was saying about that instinctual part of the brain before, noticing that the, you know, your body's in danger, it's going to do everything it can to get that weight back on, slowing your metabolism, slowing all the activities of your body, and sending out chemicals to eat as much as you can. And then people blame themselves, as I said. So much of my work, and you mentioned health at every size, so much of my work is fighting against the oppression of all marginalized communities, including people of sizes that don't fit into this culturally thin, you know, ideal. And that weight stigma, talking about health before, the weight stigma, the anti-fat bias out there is what is causing ill health for so many people, and especially mental health, feeling horrible about themselves. So I look through a social justice lens and I'm angry.
yeah, rightfully so. And one thing too I wanted to ask is, I think there's a common thread of people either intentionally or non-intentionally turning intuitive eating into a diet. Can you talk about how to prevent that?
Well, yes. And it was something that I mentioned earlier. They'll take the guidelines of intuitive eating, the principles, and turn them into rules. And so they'll say, I am only allowed to start eating when my hunger level is at a certain level. And boy, as soon as I hit that number, I've got to stop. And so what it becomes is the hunger fullness diet. And that is, you know, that's not intuitive eating. And if there's an underlying belief that the whole point of this is to lose weight, that is going to sabotage them as well. We can't determine what a person's body is going to be, you know, in terms of when they are in tune with their bodies. Their bodies might be bigger, they might be smaller, they might stay the same. It is not a weight loss plan. And that is the biggest thing, most important thing that I would want people to hear, is that intuitive eating is not about weight loss. So do not turn it into a diet, into, you know, absolutes for the purpose of losing weight.
Right. Like if you're following this, maybe your body just goes to where it's meant to be. And that's like how your body's built.
Perhaps. You know, and I do want to put in one other thought. I have no judgment about people wanting to lose weight. I mean, how can someone living in this culture who's bombarded on a regular basis about the benefits of a lower weight see the privileges that people at lower, you know, who have thin privilege have? So I understand that. So I'm not judging anyone. I'm just saying, let's challenge this. Let's look at why, you know, this is considered the only way to live one's life. Let's look at the damage that's done to you when you're pursuing something that isn't sustainable. I just wanted to say that because people sometimes think, oh, those intuitive eating women, they just hate us if we want to lose weight. That's not true.
Right, right. I think that's a common thread in all these sort of body positive, health at every size. They're like, well, they're just demonizing me if I want to lose weight or if I'm trying to lose weight for an actual medical condition. But that's not it. It's just like trusting yourself in healing, which I think exactly. is a huge part of your work. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
What effect has chronic dieting had on our hunger cues? I feel like those are very hard to find now. And why is it so crucial to tap into those?
So remember, on a diet, you are told how much to eat, you're told when to eat and what to eat. And so you're not focused on your body's hunger. And if you're in a starvation mode, if you're eating less energy, less food, food is energy, then your body needs, everything's going to slow down. There's something called gastroparesis, which is slowed stomach emptying, that will happen when someone is under eating. The purpose of that, and this is my own little scientific understanding of it, is that the slower things go through you, the more we can absorb nutritionally. So, but I don't know, it may not be really what it's about, but to me, it makes sense. And so everything slows down. People feel full more often, or they feel ravenously hungry because they're in primal hunger, which is a state of where you're not getting any energy to your brain and your body. So people get disconnected from their hunger signals. But I will tell you, Cassie, that after not such a long period of tuning into the body and eating, nourishing the body, it's self-care. I mentioned this is a self-care platform. Eating is one of the most important things for self-care, sleeping, and you know, many other things as well. But once one is eating regularly throughout the day, those hunger and fullness cues come back. It may take a while, depending on how long one has been dieting, or you know how. I have one client once who had been on a diet for 1 week. She came to me. We had one session. She was right, you know, back, but that was 1 week. So many of my clients have been on diets for years and years and years. So it takes time to get the GI tract working properly and get your signals, you know, hooked up from your brain to your stomach and your gut. We could talk about microbiome. There's a direct message from the brain to the gut through the vagus nerve. But in any case, it takes a while for it to hook back up. And when it does, boy, I know when I'm hungry. I mean, I may have eaten a really filling and delicious meal and go along with my day. And then it's like, oh, I'm hungry. I just ate. And I notice it's been a number of hours, but my body knows it's time to eat.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. And my struggle is, like, I know when I'm hungry, but I grew up in a house where you cleared your plate. And so like I struggle with the fullness part of listening because I'm used to eating so fast.
Well, there's several things with that. And I'm glad you talked about that. I do a lot of inner child work, and I believe that each of us, no matter, I'm pretty old and I still have a little kid inside of me that I am very aware of. I've got a teenager in me as well. And I think that when you've grown up with your inability to make decisions for yourself, being told to finish the plate or, you know, you can't go out and play until you're done eating or whatever it is, that little kid is still in you, even as an adult when you're eating. And so you want to become aware of the messages that are coming from your little kid and be able to say, hey, I'm an adult now. I can make decisions for myself. But the thing I think is most helpful for people to hear about, it comes from an article I wrote many years ago called The Sadness of Saying Enough. And it came from working with a teenage boy who absolutely stated, I do not eat emotionally. I have no emotions attached to my eating. We talked about, what do you do when you're angry? Oh, I go and throw some basketballs. And what do you do when you're sad? Oh, I talk to my mom or play with my dog. He was showing me all the ways that he had coping mechanisms for his emotions. However, he told me that when he ended each of his meals, he was so full, he was so uncomfortable. So I said to him one day, and using my hands to say, if your body needs this much food, and then I extended one hand and said, and then you're eating to this point, what is this about, this part that isn't for what your body needs? And he said, I don't want to feel sad that I have to stop. And that triggered an article that has resonated with so many people. And by the way, any listener who wants it, I can send you the article. They can write to me and I'll give it to them. Basically, the moment that we're about to end any pleasurable experience. I mean, I just came back from a vacation in Mexico that was wonderful. You know, at the end, it's like, got to go back to, as much as you love your work, you're still back to the, you know, the order of the day and not being, you know, autonomous and doing what you want. I notice it very much. I'm a big book reader. And when I have finished, I'm just toward the end of a novel and I want to know the conclusion. And then I'm done that last page. I'm sad. And so with food, if it's a pleasurable experience, and that's such a huge part of intuitive eating, when we're finished, you know, to a point where we know our bodies have had enough, we're comfortably full, we're satisfied, our body's satisfied, our tongue is satisfied, but we don't want to stop. We want to take a look at that feeling that shows up, that sadness, and be able to say to ourselves, okay, that's a feeling. And guess what? We get to eat whatever we want to eat the next time we're hungry, every day for the rest of our lives. And that is, I call it emotion light. It's not a deep-seated thing. It's in that moment. And it passes, and you go on to do something else, and you're hungry again and eat whatever you want. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think that's the inner child speaking to me when I'm eating makes a lot of sense.
Did you grow up with an emotionally immature, unavailable, or selfish parent? Join Lindsay C. Gibson, author of The Self-Help Hit, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, for a 6-week intensive online course. You'll learn essential skills to reclaim your true self, build emotional resilience, and nurture healthy relationships. Sign up to learn more at newharbinger.com/gibson-gift and receive a free excerpt bundle from Gibson's books. New Harbinger Online Courses, expert help for better mental health.
Another part of this work is making peace with food, which I think we all have a lot of complicated feelings about food. You know, people demonize certain foods, the cheat meal conversation. Mm-hmm. What are some of your tips for beginning to start to make peace with food?
Interestingly, I think there are two critical pieces. Number one is this the first principle, challenging the diet mentality, because we can't hold on to a belief that if this intuitive eating thing doesn't work, we're going to go on another diet. So once we have come to a place of saying, I will never go on a diet again, I understand diets don't work and they're dangerous and they're negative for me, then you're able to go to that place of liberating all the foods that you have previously thought were unhealthy or fattening. These are the words that people use that have demonized these foods. That was the word you used. And so you're able to then look at all foods as, and this is a term I love, emotionally equivalent. Meaning, now I must say I have a master's science degree in nutrition, so I do understand that broccoli may have more nutritional value than green jelly beans. However, it's how you feel about yourself is the same, whether you're eating that broccoli or the green jelly beans. You don't feel like you're a good person for eating the broccoli and a bad person for eating the candy. And so making peace with all food is coming to understand that there is no bad food. There is no good food. I like to tell people from just a digestion standpoint, as we eat food, before it's absorbed in the body, it's broken down to the basic elements of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and if it's protein, nitrogen, all foods. So, you know, it's no longer the food you're looking at as you put it in your mouth before it can be absorbed into the, you know, into the bloodstream and carbohydrates into the brain. Then it's just these basic chemicals. So how can we say some foods are bad and some foods are good? It's what we think about them that makes us feel bad, that is not good for us. And it's what society says about it.
Yeah, all that baggage. And it's interesting. I've been a vegetarian for like 5 years and I hear all the time about how I'm not getting enough protein. Like really well-meaning people in my life don't know how to like feed me when I'm over. Like it'll be like, oh, you must only eat like pasta. And I'm like, I literally eat vegetables. I just don't eat animal products. And it's just funny the associations we get like that.
Sure. And are you vegetarian or vegan? Which
vegetarian.
One? Yeah. So you actually eat some derivatives from animals and, mm-hmm. you know, you're able to get your vitamin B12 from your food because it only comes from an animal source. So that's what's so interesting. Being a vegetarian is so versatile. There's so many foods you can get everything you need from. And if you really listen to your body, if you haven't had any protein all day, you're probably going to crave some nuts or some, you know, peanut butter or some tofu or something.
Yeah.
And in your case, maybe see something dairy or eggs. And if you haven't had any fruits and vegetables for days and you're having trouble pooping, excuse me, you might decide I need to add some, you know, fruits and vegetables for the fiber. So that's intuitive. That's intuitive eating right there.
Yeah. And I think I even came to vegetarianism in an intuitive way because I was just not liking how my body felt like processing meat. And I just was like, I'm going to try it without it. And I just felt a lot better. And so I've just stuck with it. Yeah. Like, I think that's cool that I came to that on my own.
Yeah, that's interoceptive awareness, which I mentioned earlier. Your body gives you the message that your body feels better without meat. Some people don't feel as well without meat. I mean, it's all what your body is telling you. And you have a right as an autonomous being to make a choice for yourself that feels good. And then you can trust your body to tell you what you need.
Yeah. And we talked a bit about this with the inner child. Can you talk a little bit more about the role your upbringing plays in the way that you see your food?
Well, I will tell you this, that I have been doing this work for going on 41 years now. And the majority of people that come to my office with disordered eating or serious eating disorders are coming from a home where their food has been controlled, where their bodies are trying to be controlled by, you know, parents or doctors. And it deeply affects one's ability to tune in, to feel good about themselves, to eat the food that they really enjoy. And so, like you mentioned earlier, in some homes, people are told to clean the whole plate before they can go off and play. And that stays with them. And we have to challenge that and realize that that was coming from the food police, which is another principle. You know, this is people telling you what's best for you, mainly parents there, and maybe it doesn't work for you. So then there are so many homes, and I'm so sad about this, where there's such a focus on thinness that children's food is controlled and they're not allowed to have what is considered what they call junk food. I call play food because we all need time to play and we need food that is maybe not as nutrient dense, but it's just fun and it's delicious. And so they're told, no, you can't have dessert until you finish your vegetables. Well, what happens? Vegetables become then the demon. Oh, I have to get through this awful experience before I can have something enjoyable, rather than eat whatever you need, have it all on the table. And so, you know, it's just so important to look at what your little kid is telling you, what your little kid is remembering from childhood, and recognize, no, you're in charge. You're actually in charge. You can buy the food you want. And I must say, as a caveat, if someone doesn't have food security, if there are people who are in a state of poverty and just can't get what they need, then that's a whole different story. They don't have the privilege of getting all the different foods they want. And we want to be very gentle and understanding of people in that position. And really, it's a worldwide issue of poverty and a countrywide issue that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, absolutely. In the moment when you're eating, if you grew up, you know, with this clean plate mentality, or if you're having, you know, feelings versus like hunger cues. So in the moment when you're eating, what can you do to challenge these thoughts in your head?
Well, I think the first thing when you're eating is to take a moment, stay present, and ask yourself, am I enjoying this food? How does the food taste? Because as I mentioned earlier, satisfaction and pleasure are the driving force really of intuitive eating. So it's asking yourself, does the food still taste good as you're continuing to eat it? My parents told me I had to finish the whole plate. Well, wait a minute. There's a point at which when you're comfortably full, food just doesn't taste as good. Or when you've had the same, if you're given one food and you have to eat it bite after bite after bite, it's not tasting good. So the first piece is staying present. Just listen. Listen to what your body is telling you. Listen to what your tongue is telling you. And in terms of what your body's telling you, there's a point at which you are going to get that message that you've had enough, you're satisfied, your body's satisfied. And stay with that for a moment and think about that sadness of saying enough and saying, well, if I stop now, yeah, maybe I'm sad that I can't continue to eat this, but guess what? It's just going to taste so much better when I'm hungry again. So I think it's staying present is a real key here.
And then that leads me to wonder about, I think a lot of us eat distractedly with the TV on, or like I know I do a lot of mindless snacking if I'm watching shows or something with my friend. Do you recommend sitting down at the table with no distractions, or how do you go about that?
I'm not an absolutist, Cassie, at all.
Of course.
I read the newspaper in the morning, actual paper, not online,
I love it.
But actual two papers come every morning, and I'm reading the paper and I'm eating, and I am very capable of noticing my food and how delicious it is, and whether, or maybe it's not so delicious, but whatever, and noticing my hunger and fullness, because I can look at the paper and then I can look back at my food. I'm also capable of eating a meal in front of the television. So this may sound like something you wouldn't expect from me, but I think only one can know what you can do at the same time that you are eating to be able to stay present with your food. I never eat if I'm on the telephone with someone. To me, I would be completely distracted. I wouldn't enjoy my food. And that's different mm-hmm. than sitting in a restaurant and talking to someone who's also sure. eating with you. I don't flip through my phone, through social media. I'm not sitting at my computer flipping through my emails when I'm eating, because it does distract me. So I've given you examples of things that distract me and things that don't distract me. And that's why I say it's your own, intuitive wisdom to tell you what you can do. And for some people, and I have had occasional clients who really can't focus on the food unless they're just sitting with the food. But then, of course, what happens when they go out to eat with somebody else? Should they never have a meal with someone else? So we do have to learn how to stay present with the food, even with some mild distractions.
Yeah, definitely. And we talked about, the thoughts versus hunger cues and how you were brought up. How can intuitive eating help with emotional eating?
So I have some interesting thoughts about emotional eating. I have had numerous people come to my office telling me that they're binge eaters, they're emotional eaters, they're out of control eaters. And I have found that the majority of their eating beyond what their body's telling them is coming from diet mentality, is coming from this history of being deprived, not getting enough, not getting what they wanted, thinking there'll be a diet in the future. And so eating more than their bodies need right now. And so what happens is, as I help them nourish themselves throughout the day, as I help them look at their cognitive pieces, what they're thinking about food and making peace with food, as you mentioned earlier, and they are at full peace with all food, they're at a sense of they're never dieting again, then we can look at what you're calling emotional eating. And look, eating is emotional. Babies cry when they're hungry. That's an emotion. They get fed and they coo, and that's an emotion. They're happy and they're satisfied. So we demonize emotional eating. And instead of looking at it, it's just part of eating, is to have an emotion. Satisfaction, feeling satisfied, is an emotion. If it's a situation where one has not had the, benefit of having other coping mechanisms developed, and eating is the only mechanism they have to deal with feelings, well, we have to be very understanding of that. I have had clients who have had terrible abuse in childhood, terrible trauma, and food was the only thing that got them through it. And I say, thank God you had the food. It was all emotional. It was a way of protecting them. Let's be careful when we look at emotional eating and not say it's a bad thing. Let's just differentiate whether it's an emotion of pleasure, whether it's emotion of it's coping because it was the only coping mechanism, versus can one learn to have other coping mechanisms as well when, deep emotions come up. Having a therapist, having a good friend, having, being in nature, things that are nourishing to them, meditating, things like that. So it's a tricky thing. It's not just all or nothing, emotional eating, yes or no. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I'm glad I asked you that question, because I think that's a really good differentiation, because it does get demonized, much like food. Like, if you're emotional eating, quote unquote, it can be seen as a really negative, shameful thing.
I've even seen it written in books that are misrepresenting intuitive eating, saying that intuitive eating is only about eating for hunger, no other reason. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. Sometimes we just eat for pleasure. I mean, you could be completely comfortably full and walk into, your friend's house and they've just baked chocolate chip cookies and they smell wonderful and offer you one. You eat the cookie. That's not wrong. That's not bad just because you're not hungry, So yeah, it's nuanced. Intuitive eating is incredibly nuanced. And one of my pet peeves is people who use it or talk about it in a reductionist way. And that's, if you're not hungry, you can't eat.
Yeah. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I asked at the beginning about what it is and what it isn't. Cause I think when this concept became popular, a lot of people are misinterpreting what its focus is. Yeah.
Exactly.
One thing that was truly revolutionary for me and is one of the principles in the book is discovering movement that you find pleasurable. And I wonder if you could talk about why that's so important. And just, that was a game changer for me. Like, I used to do it because I hated myself, and now I do it because I love myself.
Well, that's such an important piece. How were you introduced to movement in your life? As a toddler, you just got to run around the room, and nobody told you run around the room so that you'll be healthy, you know, or thin or anything like that. Toddlers, animals move for pure joy. It's just natural. And unfortunately, as we get older, there's a whole other narrative going. You've got to exercise for health. You've got to exercise for weight. And it takes away that pleasure. And so a resistance comes up, a natural resistance. Remember, I was talking about the inner child. Well, our inner teen, also our inner toddler, because they're very similar, is going to say, no, if you're telling me to exercise for those reasons, no, I'm not going to do it. But when you put the focus on feeling good, then you're driven to want to move your body. I know that in the morning, if every morning, no matter how many hours I've had of sleep, I'll wake up and I'm a little groggy. And if I move my body some, I wake up and it feels good. And I feel better during the day than days when I don't get that opportunity. And it's not absolutist, and I can't every day. So, and doing things that are fun for you. If you're someone who loves to bike, you know, you want to get on your bike and feel like you're a kid, get on your bike. If you love to swim, if you have access to, you know, the ocean or a pool, swim, dance. I have found that for some of my clients who have really had a hard time with movement, if they turn on music, close their door, their bedroom door, and just start dancing, they love it. In fact, I was my niece, who has always been negative about exercise, and she's in her 40s, found that she was having some problems with her bones. And her doctor suggested that she do some exercise for weight-bearing exercise so that her bones would be stronger, not weight, but weight-bearing exercise. And she was so grumbling about it, but she's a dancer. She met her husband in salsa dancing. And so she realized that she could do some dance videos, and now she's dancing and loving it. So I think that when you find something that feels good to you and that is fun for you and pleasurable, it's a non-issue. You don't fight it. You just do it because you want to feel good.
If you're just starting out too, and you do have that roadblock of exercise, what steps do you recommend somebody take to start to discover what they actually like?
So to understand that that exercise resistance comes for a reason. And so it's going back in time and thinking about the feelings you had when you were pushed to exercise for reasons that didn't feel good to you. And to be able to have a conversation with that little kid in you or teenager in you and be able to say, that's okay. I get it. That didn't feel good. But, you know, right now as an adult, if you're an adult or an older teenager, I do want to feel better and I do want to do something fun. So it's having that conversation with the person, the younger person inside of you, and helping them understand that, yeah, of course you have this exercise resistance because it was pushed on you, or it might have been pushed on you to lose weight. And now you're in a place where health at every size, where you understand that all bodies need, you know, deserve respect and equality and all of that. And it's like, yeah, I was only told to exercise so I could lose weight, and I'm not focused on weight loss, so I'm not doing that. And be able to say, okay, that was an old narrative. Let's look at, again, what feels good and what's fun. So it's challenging where that exercise resistance comes from, and being able to pull yourself out of that and make an autonomous choice as an older person, older teenager, to do what's best for you.
All this inner work just seems so valuable, because the alternative is to keep feeling bad and going through patterns, trying to avoid working through these things that are actually going to ultimately serve you.
Yes. So I know that's why I say I'm very much of an inner child advocate, because I just know from my own experience how my inner child and teenager can affect me. And I think if people start to come to terms with that, and they'll say, oh, that's silly, I don't have a kid inside me. Well, you don't have the actual kid, you know, you have the
literally
thoughts and feelings of that child that stay with you throughout your life. And now as an adult who can be more nurturing, you can have that inner conversation.
The last of the 10 principles is to honor your health with gentle nutrition. Can you talk about what that might look like beginning that journey?
Well, the first thing I want to say is don't go there unless you are absolutely fully embracing the beauty and wonder of intuitive eating. And you're at a point where you're not going to be driven toward good food, bad food, because you start thinking about nutrition. So it's very important, imperative, that you ask yourself, where am I in this journey? And might I get triggered into some old thinking if I think about nutrition? What happens for my clients is that it becomes an organic process. They've gone so far in the process and they come to a point of saying, you know, what I was saying earlier, my GI tract isn't working so well. Elise, help me figure out what kinds of foods I could eat that would, you know, help it, help my GI tract work. That's gentle nutrition. It's not you should eat something. It's coming to it from your own interoceptive awareness that your body maybe isn't feeling as optimally as it can. Now, there could be some mental pieces of it. You know, you're getting older and you think that, you know, you might need to get some foods that have calcium in them so that your bones are stronger, because you've heard that, you've read about that. And that's true. And then you decide, well, I think I want to incorporate some more dairy foods so I can get the calcium. So it's not about an external mandate of eating certain foods that have certain vitamins or minerals or, you know, or fiber. It's more, what is your body telling you? And what can you include? It's never taking anything away. It's always, what can you include to maybe perhaps feel better again, you know, like with the movement.
This is just, I keep thinking of, you know, when you go on a vacation, you mentioned you're just on one and you're eating maybe richer foods than you normally are. And you may be eating more, like that feeling when you get home and you can't wait to like eat a vegetable. Like, that's what I keep thinking of.
Well, I will tell you, back in 1988, well before you were born, I went to...
I was born in 89, so not that far off.
Okay, well, not maybe a year before. I went on a trip to what was the former Soviet Union, and it was very controlled eating. We had to eat all of our meals in the hotel, and there wasn't a vegetable or a salad really for 10 days. And that's all I wanted when I got home, exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, sometimes your body is saying to you, yeah, I need more of this or I need less of that. But it's never a rule. It's never a should. And I don't believe in vacation mentality, like throwing out your connection with your body because you're on vacation.
Yeah, exactly. And as we start to wrap up, what would you say to someone who's ready to begin their intuitive eating journey, but they're feeling maybe a little overwhelmed with all this inner work they're going to have to do?
Yes. I make it very simple. Would you like to have more enjoyable meals? That's the first question I ask. Of course, that's attached to, do you believe you deserve to have satisfaction in your eating? If someone doesn't believe that, they need to be in therapy working on why they're feeling that they don't deserve to have their needs met. Mm-hmm. But most people answer, well, sure, I would love that. Okay, so just think about satisfaction. Just ask yourself, when do I get the most satisfaction? And that will lead someone, going back to the hunger and fullness piece. You don't have to think about hunger and fullness. You just have to think about, how does the food taste best to me? For example, I'll ask someone, would you eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the car on your way to your favorite restaurant for an elegant dinner? And inevitably they say, well, no, duh, Elise, of course I wouldn't. And I go, right, why not? And they say, well, I wouldn't have an appetite. Because they know that if they have a mild amount of hunger, or a maybe even a little more than mild, but not ravenous, they're going to enjoy their food so much more. So bingo, it's satisfaction. So that helps them start to eat when they have comfortable hunger, not ravenous, not completely empty, and also not full. So the idea of eating when you have no hunger, it's not very appetizing. It's not going to be very satisfying. So that helps you guide you, or this person who's starting intuitive eating, without it getting all complicated. Don't worry about all those other deep things I was talking about when you're starting this journey. They'll show up on the way. Just strive for the most satisfying meals or snacks that you can get, and what the conditions are that make it more satisfying.
That's such good advice. And Elise, do you have any final thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, I do. there is an incredible amount of freedom and joy in life when you have let go of fighting your food, fighting your body, embracing intuitive eating, trusting that your body has wisdom, that you don't have to ever again follow some external rules or deprivations. So think about that freedom that comes with it. And it takes a while, obviously, to let go of the old ways, but the freedom is amazing. I had my own eating disorder when I was younger, and it was dieting and eating beyond fullness, binging, dieting and binging. And I haven't had a problem in 40 years. And it's just, it's so wonderful. I actually say that intuitive eating is awesome. Not the way teenagers say awesome, but you know, it is full of awe to me that I get to have such pleasure and joy in eating and feel good. So.
I mean, who wouldn't want that? Yeah, that's such...
right.
Like, who doesn't want that? We all need that. Thank you so much, Elise, for this conversation and for literally changing the game with the way we see food, the way we see ourselves. I really appreciate your time and all of your work.
Well, thank you again for inviting me. I obviously, this is my favorite topic. So thank you so much.
Do you use food to comfort yourself during stressful times? The Intuitive Eating Workbook offers a comprehensive, evidence-based program to help you develop a healthy relationship with food, pay attention to cues of hunger and satisfaction, and cultivate a profound connection with your mind and body. Have you tried fad diet after fad diet only to gain weight back? Maybe you've tried the protein diet only to move on to vegetables only, raw almonds and coconut water every 45 minutes instead of big meals, or perhaps you've tried counting calories, but the numbers on the scale don't add up. If you're ready to throw in your hat and give up on dieting for good, take heart. You can enjoy food again. You just need to pay attention to your body's natural hunger cues. Based on the author's best-selling book, Intuitive Eating, this workbook can show you how. The Intuitive Eating Workbook offers a new way of looking at food and mealtime by showing you how to recognize your body's natural hunger signals. Structured around the 10 principles of intuitive eating, the mindful approach in this workbook encourages you to abandon unhealthy weight control behaviors, develop positive body image, and most importantly, stop feeling distressed around food. You were born with all the wisdom you need for eating intuitively. This book will help you reconnect with that wisdom and ultimately change your life one meal at a time. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change. Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives. Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozzle, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.